Hello and welcome to History in Reverse, a father-daughter science fiction podcast. Today we're talking about Brave New World. Hello, welcome to History in Reverse. Today we're talking about Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. My name is Caroline, and here with me is my father, Richie.
Hello.
All right, and we're talking about a classic, so we're actually starting this year. This is our first podcast of the year, right?
No, second.
Is it? Oh, we did the Roundup podcast. Right. Yeah. So now we're moving on. If you've been following our podcast, basically what we do is every few months we read a book. We read a book and sit and discuss it. The first batch of books that we did were Strange Aliens. That was the theme. And then we did a sort of roundup podcast about it, which was the last one in the feed, where we talked about all the different books and sort of compared the literary merits across across the century.
Right.
And now we're moving on to dystopias, which is a great subgenre of science fiction. And we're starting with one of the classics, Brave New World, which I'm sure everyone has read. And I've read a few. I read when I was much younger.
I've read it before also, yeah.
Yeah, and the interesting thing at this time is I listened to the audiobook. I think you did too,
yeah,
right?
I did too, yeah.
This is the first book that I've listened to the audiobook without having, like, read the text very recently. Because the only other audiobooks I've listened to are the A Song of Ice and Fire books because I have a problem.
And, yes, you do.
And I actually found it quite difficult to follow the audiobook, but you and I reviewed the characters. I got a lot of the characters confused from just listening to the audiobook, but I have actually read the text before. So before we jump into Brave New World, I know you looked up some history stuff.
Right, so I want to talk a little bit about history of dystopias and stuff. So one interesting thing is the paper copy of Brave New World that we have has an introduction by Christopher Hitchens.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, he mentions that Aldous Huxley was actually a teacher of George Orwell,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of funny. And there was actually a book written earlier in 1920s that kind of started the genre of this kind of futuristic dystopias. And it was called We, mm-hmm. as you and me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was written by a Russian named Yevgeny Zaimatin.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's how I pronounce it. It was written in 1920. And I read it actually prior.
Yeah, you were reading it for something else.
And I found it a slug. It was kind of hard to read. And we were, you know, when we were discussing it, our book discussion group, we were wondering whether this was the translation or just the writing was bad. One thing that he did in that particular book was like he threw random math terms
mm-hmm.
that had nothing to do with anything, and it just seemed very strange.
Mm-hmm.
Orwell, later in his life, wrote an essay criticizing Huxley for Brave New World being too derivative of this book, We.
Right. Well, you were telling me about the plot of We, and it sounds very, very similar.
Yes.
Right? Like they have the sort of civilized area and then the uncivilized area, you said, beyond the wall, right?
Right. Mm. Right.
But that's... So I guess that would be the 1920s, you said?
Right, 1920s. And Brave New World was written in 1932.
Okay.
So what about utopias, dystopias? Explain.
So, I mean, broadly speaking, we're starting to read dystopias and the idea of a utopia, I'm going to go back to like my college philosophy classes. It was like, it's like this sort of ancient idea of a perfect society. I think the fascination with utopias is that they so easily border on dystopia because of what we value as individuals, particularly I think freedom and free will being things that a utopia, by nature of being a utopia, can't necessarily have. And then dystopias appear in a few different ways. So we have the dystopia here in Brave New World, and as we go through the next year or so and we're reading other dystopias, well, I'm sure we'll see different examples. But other famous dystopia would be like 1984.
Right.
The Hunger Games is a recent dystopia series.
Right.
And usually, I'm gonna say usually, I'm not sure if this is entirely true, usually dystopias are more about like an oppressive government that's like very controlling and whatever, you know, is evil for some way, but it's like clearly evil. Brave New World is sort of interesting because it's that utopia that borders on dystopia thing, where, and I think one of the questions we're going to get to during this podcast is why do we consider this a dystopia,
right,
as opposed to a utopia?
Right.
And the fascination between dystopia and utopia comes from the fact that they are so similar in a lot of ways, even though they're supposed to be opposites. You know, utopia is supposed to be perfect, dystopia is supposed to be terrible. So do you want to get into the...
Shall we just talk about the plot, roughly, or the main characters?
Yeah, well, let's talk through the plot and as the characters come up, because the plot's not actually that complicated, which is interesting. So one of the upshots of listening to the audiobook was that I realized how long it took them to really get to the main plot. It takes 2 hours before we meet Linda.
Right, so the beginning of it, I guess they describe, they want to give you the sense of what the society is like.
Right.
In this world.
So it's a third-person narration. We're not dealing with close point of view. We're not dealing with any first-person stuff like that. It's your kind of classic third-person narration throughout. And yeah, we just start with like sort of a few different characters. There's Lenina.
Right.
Who's
Bernard.
So who's Lenina?
Right. So Lenina is this nice girl who works in the hatcheries. So just to step back a little bit, so the world he describes in this book is basically humans are no longer born of the mothers.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse my French. And they hatch in the hatcheries.
Mm-hmm.
And they divide it into classes of people, like alpha, betas, gammas, epsilons.
Epsilon.
I think is the lowest one.
Epsilon's the lowest, yeah.
And basically they're raised to be conditioned to fit into one of those classes, and the idea is that whatever class you're in, you're kind of conditioned and prepared to do particular jobs in a society,
mm-hmm.
and that's exactly what you want to do.
Right, because you've been, not exactly bred for it, but you've been conditioned for it.
Right, so I think the conditioning, as in, you know, Pavlov's dog and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. So, for example, some things they do for conditioning is the, because I think that in the story they tell the story of the child that learns something from...
Right, they talk about how the whole thing was discovered.
Right.
Where, I guess at the time, the idea of conditioning while you sleep...
Mm-hmm. What's it called in the story? Hypnopedia. Hypnopedia, right. The idea that as you're sleeping, you hear something repeated to you, and so you internalize that
right.
as true. And that's one of the main ways that they condition, is that they do these repetitions, and thousands and thousands of times.
Right.
For the children, and a lot of them are these like rhymes, you know. Okay.
Well, also the even before that in the hatcheries, they mm-hmm. when they basically prepare the embryos and kind of manage them as they grow,
mm-hmm.
As they develop into children, and they add various different things at various points to
mm-hmm.
make sure that you become a alpha or beta or the gamma or
right,
whatever.
Exactly. So there's sort of two. There's kind of two ways that they do it. They do, or maybe three. There's sort of the chemical way very early on. There's hypnopedia conditioning, and then there's just like other training and conditioning that comes later. So like you were just saying, like the chemical stuff, for example, they start with like 100 of the same or 100 embryos, and they want 50 of them to be epsilons. So they add like alcohol to their surrogate
right.
or something. Like it's like they add like some weird thing, and it like stunts.
And do you remember the Bakhanovsky process?
I do, but do you want to explain the Bakhanovsky process?
Right, so the Bakhanovsky process was to basically take a single egg or single embryo
mm-hmm.
and create, you know, make buds so that you can make, you know, a 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 people
mm-hmm.
from just single egg. So it would be essentially all, you know, I don't want to call them twins because there's more than two, but
yeah.
they're all identically.
And the max number they could get was like 96.
Right.
I think. Yeah. And so they're all identical. And that actually gets into the way the social castes are kind of done, because the lower castes in this world have a lot of repetitions, whereas the alphas are all individuals.
Right.
Which maybe ties into the free will stuff later on. So that's kind of like the first part of the story is really spent setting this up and talking about there's this chemical conditioning, there's the hypnopedia, and a lot of the hypnopedic phrases, which I think is really interesting. Are like rhymes, you know, a gram is better than a dam, stuff like that.
Right, that's right.
You know, and they're all like these cutesy little rhymes that the kids learn, you know, everyone belongs to everyone else.
Right.
Stuff like that, that becomes ingrained in them because it's just repeated over and
right.
over.
And I thought it was kind of cute, literally device, the way he introduces this is like there's a scene in the hatchery and a class comes to visit
mm-hmm.
and the director shows him around explaining
yeah.
what happens in different spots.
Well, it's like in what's the Lem book you made me read with the ocean?
Solaris.
So in Solaris, when the main character's just like, You know, the author is like, we need some time, I need some exposition space. And the main character goes and reads a book about history,
right,
you know?
Right.
It was a very interesting literary frame to get that exposition
out.
Right. And a portion of the beginning of the book is written, but at least from what I could tell from listening to the audiobook, it's sort of written between scenes of the hatchery, Lenina, and
right,
and
he does a lot of this cutting away from one scene to the next, especially in the beginning, you're right.
Mm-hmm.
So there was the hatchery where the director was explaining to the class what different mm-hmm. pieces are. Lenina, who was one of the people who worked there, and she and her friend were, I guess, in a locker room or something, some locker room talk about dating. And Bernard is Bernard Marx.
Yeah, it's one of the characters.
Who's kind of has kind of the, I don't want to say hots for Lenina, but he likes Lenina. But he's kind of shy.
Yeah, he's kind of weird.
Now the because children are made in factories essentially, there is no sex is just basically a fun thing
mm-hmm.
that you do,
mm-hmm.
and there's nothing to reproduction.
Right. So nobody births live children anymore.
Right. That's ew.
Yeah. And a lot of the population is sterile. One of the things that they do with the chemical conditioning of the fetuses is that they sterilize. But then there are some people that aren't sterile, and I couldn't quite figure out why that is.
Like, right, that takes some birth control thing or something.
Yeah, I don't know. I couldn't quite figure it out. I don't know. Just for funsies. So we start the story basically with that information dump on, like, this is the world that we're in.
Right.
And I think one of the things we see throughout the story is that this book is much more about the world building than it is about the characters of the plot. Not that the characters in the plot aren't interesting,
right,
but I think they are subservient to the world building.
Well, he describes this culture, right, so and this world. And so one other thing that gets mentioned is Soma. You want to explain that?
Yes. Soma is a drug that, depending on how much of it you take, basically induces a euphoria. It's like people call it going on Soma holiday. And you could take half a gram and like feel good, and take a whole gram and feel much better. You take 3 grams and like you're basically like asleep but in like a euphoric state for several hours. It's used as a way for the government to really control people and
just to avoid negative emotions or whatever.
Right. And to motivate people.
That's true.
You know, they get paid in Soma tablets a lot. And you know, it's
that's right, a gram is better than a dam.
A gram is better than a dam. Every time someone says the word damn to Lenina, she always responds, a gram is better than a dam, every single time. It's fantastic.
So Bertrand is one of those people who does not like to take Soma. He wants mm-hmm. to be, sometimes miserable, and he wants to remain miserable.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that is one of the first conversations, Lenina and her friend Fanny.
Fanny, yeah.
Talk about Bernard. And Fanny says, he's weird. They, you know, they accidentally put like alcohol in his surrogate when he was in the test tube or whatever. And
he's like an alpha minus or something.
Yeah, and I think it's so interesting how because the conditioning is so consistent,
mm-hmm.
really, across, that whenever there are these outliers, the immediate explanation is, oh, well, something went wrong with the conditioning process. Like, there must have been something incorrectly
done. Right,
right. Which is a really interesting cultural bit, you know, for how the characters react to living in this world. So what are the actual events that happen? So we have Lenina working, and basically what's happening is everyone belongs to everyone else in the society, so
right.
the adults, there's no marriage,
right.
there are no families, and you're expected to have multiple partners at all times, basically.
Right. So they actually talk about some of the entertainment. I think Huxley was trying to be a little bit funny because like he made up a bunch of interesting sports that they would play. So I wrote some down. It was the Riemann surface tennis, obstacle golf, escalator squash.
Yeah.
And Riemann surface is actually a thing in mathematics, so it doesn't even make sense, but it's kind of funny.
Anything to do with tennis?
No. It's like a surface that is four-dimensional and stuff, so it's like it doesn't make any sense.
Oh.
And who was Mustafa Mond?
He's the controller, right?
The world controller.
Yeah. Do you want to explain what that is?
Well, I guess he's like
he's like the president.
The president, kind of, yeah. I mean,
this happens in England.
Right. It sounds like the each region has a controller because they talk about some other ones
mm-hmm.
elsewhere.
Right. I love the name Mustafa Mond, by the way. I think it's great. It's like a great supervillain theme.
So the other thing they talk about is that the society they want is stable. They want stability. They don't want really much change. Yeah. They want everybody to be happy.
One of the things that's talked about towards the end of the book in that philosophy part that you like is the reason they wanted that stability was because they were coming out of a war, like the 9 years war.
There was a 9 years war. So what about our Ford?
I didn't get this. You explain.
Okay, so throughout the book, you notice they make expressions that sound like religious things, but they're not. So they talk about, you know, we are in a year 2000-something of our Ford, or after Ford.
After Ford, yeah.
And oh, they call people your Fordship and make sign of a T. What Huxley was doing, he was just referring to Henry Ford and basically the factory invention and Model T and stuff, and kind of riffing on that as that was the beginning of the modern era. Mm-hmm. And they do talk briefly about there was a 9 years war that was really terrible, and after that they decided to implement this kind of system where to have stability and happiness for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. And the important thing about, you know, disconditioning was that people who were, you know, betas or deltas or epsilons, they were happy doing what they were doing because they were just basically bred and conditioned to just love doing that.
Right.
And they couldn't see themselves doing anything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And it sort of removes, I guess the goal, and kind of the same way they removed religion and stuff, is that, they removed the family unit, is to remove any extreme emotion. That kind of seemed to be the idea, because you don't love any one person enough to like think of them as yours.
Right.
For example, you don't love any child to think of it as yours. Like that concept of the extreme emotions, extreme sadness, extreme love, extreme happiness. Like those things were all removed, so that everyone sort of had this sort of happy middle, and could be maintained and be stable. So
I guess the first thing that happens is that Bertrand and Lenin are planning a vacation.
Right. Isn't it Bernard? Isn't that his name?
Bernard.
How do you say
Bernard,
it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you're right, Bernard.
Yeah. So Lenin was dating
Bernard.
Well, she was
Benito
dating
Hoover. Foster.
I think she was just dating Henry first, right? That was she was only dating the one guy, and her roommate's like,
"You gotta get other guys.
What are you doing? Like, you can't just date the one guy." And Lenin is like, "All right." So she starts dating Bernard. Bernard's kind of weird, and everyone's like, wow, he's kind of weird. He is kind of weird.
Yeah.
And they plan this vacation to...
the Savage Reservation.
Yeah. Was it in New Mexico?
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're in England, so I guess they go over to...
Part of the world that they were in, the world they were in, there were like areas allocated that were still like living in the old ways, you know, and they were like vacation spots.
Mm-hmm.
It was an interesting thing because when Bernard... goes tell his director of the hatchery where he works, saying, "Oh, I'm taking vacation, and we're going to this reservation."
Mm-hmm.
The guy says, "Oh yeah, I went there when I was like your age.
Yeah,
and I was with this girl, and she got lost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we went sleeping in a tent out in the wilderness, and then there was a thunderstorm or something, and she left the tent, and we couldn't find her. She got lost." And he just told him the story.
And he like assumed she was killed by the savages because they could never find her.
Oh,
yeah.
She died somewhere, yeah.
Yeah.
And
Because this is like the thing about the reservation is not a lot of people go there. It's a vacation spot, but you need a certain clearance to go.
Right.
So Bernard had the clearance, which is how Lenina ended up being able to go, because Bernard had the clearance. So Bernard's boss had the clearance as well.
Right.
So, you know, perfectly fine story. Certainly not going to come up again later on. So they go. There's a lot of commentary, and we'll sort of get into the commentary between Bernard and Lenina. I mean, Bernard likes Lenina.
Right.
But he also sort of has this, and particularly in the beginning of the story, he has this, like, sort of inner monologue about how she's, like, kind of like a piece of meat, and people see her that way, and she sees herself that way, and things like that.
Right,
that
his conditioning didn't take, or something.
Yeah, it's, like, it's interesting. So they go on this vacation, and they go to the Savage Reservation. What do they see at the Savage Reservation?
So at the Savage Reservation, they go visit a pueblo of Indians, just to observe their rituals and stuff. And you know, Lenin thinks it's terrible, because it's, like, all dirty,
They see women breastfeeding at one point, I think.
Right.
Then it's just awful. She hates it.
And then they observe some kind of what seems like a religious ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
And
With the whipping.
The whipping.
The first time we see whipping. There's a lot of whipping in the story.
And there's a cross. You know, yeah. There's some mixture of some Christianity in there. And at the end of the ceremony, this kid comes out, like a young man,
mm-hmm.
who's not an Indian.
Right. He's white.
He's white.
He's got blonde hair. I forgot if he's blue eyes.
I don't remember.
He's got blonde hair, though. He's got straw-colored hair.
And he's clearly not entirely accepted by the tribe,
mm-hmm.
right? And he, you know, part of the ceremony was there was, like, young man who was being hit with a whip and to see how many
how much hits, suffering he could endure.
Yeah, he could endure, yeah. and he said, oh, I could have done more.
Yeah.
And they talking to him because he's so white,
mm-hmm.
and not an Indian, and they discovered that he has a mother, which is like a dirty word in their world.
Mm-hmm.
And the mother is the girl that was lost.
Yep.
Her name is Linda.
Yep. So they go and see Linda.
Right. And I think Linda, who was the father?
That's got to have been the I thought it was supposed to be the guy back at the...
That's right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So the what was that character's name? I get all the white guys
confused. I don't remember. And the director's name. It wasn't Henry Foster. It was...
No.
He had some name, but...
It was, yeah, the director. They... I got... Because I wasn't reading... Again, because I wasn't reading the text, I got a lot of the male characters confused with each other. But they go meet Linda, and Linda has... She was... So she was born, you know, she was from a bottle, like everyone else, in quote-unquote civilized society.
Right.
And she, you know, got trapped, basically, on this right. reservation and was never found.
Right.
So she gets lost when she's there and she's younger, and she ends up having this child.
Well, she lives with the Indians, right?
Yeah.
And there's, I guess, some of the backstory, what happened to John. So this guy named is John, mm-hmm. right? And I guess they called him Savage, John yeah, Savage.
John Savage.
And she taught him to read,
mm-hmm.
which the Indians did not read, and somewhere they found a book of all the works of Shakespeare, and that was like the only book he had to read, other than like the manual for how not to get pregnant or something.
Yeah. And he sort of makes this interesting moment of growth for John, because he's growing up on this reservation, he's sort of hearing about this civilized society from his mother, and he learns to read, sort of learns language from Linda, but then finds this Shakespeare book, and Linda thinks nothing of this book of Shakespeare works. Like, she's just like, I don't understand it. But she says, like, it's supposed to be really old, and it must be really old, because when I read it, it doesn't make any sense.
Right.
And then John reads it, and he gains vocabulary from it.
And kind of a world view.
Right. And sort of this, like, this very kind of overdramatic view of the world, and this overdramatic language. And he has, like, a moment where he's, like, angry at something, and he's finally able to express it because he's learned the words from Shakespeare. And if John's character has one thing about it, he is overdramatic. He is an overdramatic teenager.
Right, he's, like, 18 or something.
I think he's 18. That was the
So the interesting part about, though, you know, when they talk, there's some chapters talking about what happened to Linda and what happened to John. So Linda came from society where, you know, sex was just nothing. You just had mm-hmm. sex with whoever you wanted,
mm-hmm.
and it was normal. And of course, in the Indian society, that was not, that was traditional society where, you know, people got married. And,
right.
And so Linda was not very popular with the women.
No.
And she was very popular with the men.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, though, John was kind of an outcast.
Yeah, so he is kind of between two worlds in a lot right. of ways, because he's very, very loyal to his mother.
Right.
But also desperately wants to fit in to right. the Native American tribe that he's born into. And he there's no way to reconcile that.
Right.
Right, there's no way to bring those two worlds together, really. And that's like his struggle the whole time.
So there was one interesting thing that occurred twice in the book, which mm-hmm. I kind of want to mention. So there was one point when he's in living with the Indians, and he's old enough to learn some skills.
Mm-hmm.
And he becomes like an apprentice to somebody who makes pots from clay.
Yeah.
Right, so he goes and works with this man on clay.
Mm-hmm.
And just the fact, he says, that he was able to work and make stuff made him super happy. That was mm-hmm. like very few times when he was very happy.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of, and this is something that we talk about a lot, when you have some interest or hobby and you get absorbed in your work, mm-hmm. it's kind of a very pleasurable experience, mm-hmm. right? And that comes up later on at the very end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. With the making the bow?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what he makes a whip. Yeah.
Well, I wonder too if that's kind of the idea behind the drug soma.
Is that right? But I think it's what Huxley observes, I suppose, is that that's like a human part of human condition, is that like when you are making something with your hands or with your mind, when you're creating something, that's kind of absorbing and makes you happy.
But I think the reason it makes you happy is because you become so absorbed in it that the rest of the world falls away, right? And that's the entire idea of a soma holiday.
I guess, yeah.
Is that that moment becomes eternity.
Right.
That's the whole point.
Right.
So, look at that. It's like a metaphor.
Living in the present, you know.
Being mindful. Be mindful.
Right. Right, so he discovered mindfulness.
Yes. Okay, so they meet Linda. And poor Lena, I think we see Linda initially through Lena's eyes, if I remember.
A little bit, because she got fat and
yeah, she's like, oh my God, she's fat. How dare
she? Ugly,
you know?
Old, you know.
Yeah, and she's only like her 40s or something. She's not even old. Linda's not
right.
Old. I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Linda's really happy to be back, or to have contact.
Well, I mean, so they decided to take them back to civilization.
They had to get permission, and so one of the things that's happening is that Bernard was going to be sent away prior to this.
Right, Bernard was having some issues because of his moodiness and stuff. And
they were going to send him to Iceland.
Right.
Which is kind of like, it was still like a job, but it was kind of like the way to like push him to the side.
Yeah.
But then he comes back with the savage.
So then he comes back with the savage, right, and Linda. So Linda is happy to be back. She just goes in bed and pops like ton of soma, and that's it.
But before she pops a ton of soma, who did they bring her to see?
Well, right, so this is what happened. Bernard wanted to, I suppose, get his revenge on the director who wanted to send him away. Mm. So they bring Linda and Savage to the hatchery and introduce him to the director and saying, here is your son, John Savage, and here is his mother.
Yeah.
And of course, the guy just, oh my God, grabs his head, runs away. He's never been seen again.
Yeah. And it's like super embarrassing. And this is actually something we were talking about before the podcast. The words... father and mother, and then that scene is like sort of the best example. The word father is spoken, and everyone who's there starts to laugh, and they're laughing at the idea of the director being a father. It's just like so funny.
Right.
And then Linda says, you know, I'm his mother, and everyone reacts like very negatively, like it's like a curse word.
Yeah, it's like a very dirty kind of...
It's a very serious curse, basically. And I think that's, a lot of what is going on in Brave New World has to do with sexism and misogyny and things like that, and that's definitely an easy example.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the sexism that would be natural to people in those days mm-hmm. kind of comes out, even though it's supposed to be the future.
Yeah,
it just doesn't quite go away.
Right. So that's like a good example and a good scene. So if any of you are writing like a book report on this, that's a good scene to pull from.
So then what happens is, so Linda goes to hospital, I guess, or like to retirement home or something.
Yeah, and then she's just taking
just pops soma and she's happy.
And the thing about soma is that it shortens your lifespan.
Right.
Now, for the regular folk of Brave New World's civilized society, that's okay because everyone dies when they're like 60 or 65 or something, right?
Right.
They're like going...
Well, they have like anti-aging something or other, so there's nobody who looks old.
Right. And then, but then like when there's a certain age where they like...
They're also conditioned to expect to die and that's not a big deal.
Yeah. Exactly. But Linda's taking such heavy doses of soma that the doctors give her a month or two months to live. A
couple of months,
yeah. And John is kind of like, what the hell, guys? And they're like, what? She's having a good time.
Yeah. So, but meanwhile... So we have to introduce the other character, Helmholtz Watson.
Yes, you introduce Helmholtz Watson.
Right, so Helmholtz Watson was a friend of Bernard, and he was like an alpha plus, meaning very smart. Mm-hmm. And he was writing scripts for the Feelies, mm-hmm. which were the movies of the day.
Which is an interesting science fiction concept, the idea that, like, you can be watching something and
feel what the character
feels. So, like, they go to see one, for example, and someone gets kissed and John feels, like, the sensation on his lips and that kind of thing, yeah.
But this guy, Helmholtz Watson, wants to be more.
Yes.
You know, writing feelies, he feels they're stupid. And so he's one of those also misfits. And even though he's more popular than Bernard or whatever, they kind of hang out together and talk about stuff.
Yeah.
And so when John Savage arrives, basically he moves in with Bernard. Mm-hmm. And Bernard becomes like an instant celebrity.
Yeah.
Because everybody wants to go see the Savage.
Mm-hmm.
Right. He takes great, he really wallows in that. He's like the guy who won the lottery, you know, and he's just throwing his money around and he's throwing these parties. But John actually has a thing for Lenina. So why don't you explain that?
Okay, so John and Lenina, I think
since she was the first girl he met outside the...
Right. I think John and Lenina's relationship is just so fascinating from so many angles. But what happens with them is that the two of them simultaneously are attracted to each other for no other... And they like each other for no other reason than that they are attracted to each other, right? And it's very Romeo and Juliet in a lot
well,
of
ways. Well, it's almost like the forbidden fruit. Like, this is the first girl he sees from the civilized world.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like the first man she sees that who finds attractive who's like not like any of the other guys he knows.
Exactly.
Knows, right?
Well, they're star-crossed lovers. This is very Romeo and Juliet, so, which I'm sure is intentional. And I mean, the thing about them is they have basically nothing in common with each other. They don't
right.
really ever talk about much either.
Right.
Whenever they do speak to each other, it's all basically just them speaking past each other. They don't
right.
really understand each
right.
other's point of views at
right.
all. But they do find each other attractive. And they just don't have like any capacity to act on it in any kind of control.
Well, right, so the you have to, again, go back to the attitudes, right? Lenina is from the society where, you know, everybody sleeps with everybody and it's not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And to John, being in love with somebody and become sexually active with them is a big deal.
You have to be married.
Yeah, well, you have
eyes.
To be married
yeah.
or, and you have to, you know, and he also feels like you have to be worthy.
He definitely has this complex of not feeling worthy. But so by part of it for Lenina, for example, is that she several times makes moves on John, and he doesn't accept.
He rejects it terribly.
Multiple times, yeah. And she takes that as like a really like a personal slight, and she does not understand. Do you remember the vacuum conversation that they have?
No.
I think it's after their. It may be after the Feelies date. They go on a date to the Feelies at some point. It's cute.
Right.
But they have this conversation where she's like, she's trying to make moves on him, and he's saying, I'm not worthy of you, but I would do so much for you. And he says, I would even sweep the floor. And she's like, but we have vacuums.
Right, that's
and
right.
And it's like, this is completely missing each other, completely
right.
not even. And
right.
he's like, he doesn't get her comment about vacuums. She doesn't get why he wants to sweep the floor. And it's just this like, awful
right,
miscommunication.
Right. And there's this bad scene where she gets undressed in front of him.
Yeah.
And he just freaks out.
Yeah, he doesn't know what to do.
And he knows what to do, but he doesn't want to, you know, he doesn't feel he's worthy. So he gets really angry. She has to hide in the bathroom.
Oh, he hits her. Yeah, that's when he hits her. I think that's the last scene before Linda.
Oh, Linda. Yeah. But so, well, before that happens, I think there's also the party. In the beginning, I think John was kind of interested in the society and stuff, but then he's becoming more unhappy about it.
It's interesting because with the way he phrases it, he says that he feels he's being, like, corrupted or made dirty by it.
Right.
Which is kind of interesting because the civilized...
He's the savage, right?
Right, he's the savage and the civilized world is so clean. And one of the things it's made a point of that Linda talks about and Lenina talked about is that the savage reservation is so dirty. And the civilized place is so, like, sanitary, clean in, like, a sanitary
right.
kind of way. But then you have these
interesting
moral things that are kind of, to the modern reader, are sort of flipped. Where
right.
the sexual openness of all of the people in the civilized place, like, to a modern reader, or even a reader, especially reader in the 1930s, would seem very, like, dirty. Whereas the more conservative sexualities of the people in the reservation
right.
would seem
normal,
pure,
yeah.
right? And
right.
so there's like
yeah.
this sort of dichotomy between the two, and John is right in the middle of that.
Yeah, he's like, he can't reconcile that stuff. And
yeah.
So at one of the parties, basically, Bernard throws this huge party, right? Like, he's a big celebrity, all these important people come, and John will not come out of his room.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, they came to meet the savage, and the savage just won't come out, and he just yells at, and they can't get him to come out.
Yeah.
And eventually, everybody kind of just says, "All right, enough of this."
Yeah, and although everyone feels tricked, and
Bernard loses his specialness.
Yeah, oh, poor Bernard, such a struggle bus.
Yeah.
So yeah, the party happens, and then I think that's when. That's from the scene where.
Right, so then he goes to visit Linda, right? And Linda is dying.
So what happens is the date where London starts to get naked and John hits her.
Right, so after...
So what happens in that scene is kind of interesting because basically, again, because they're really not communicating with each other well, London starts to come on to John and he's saying, like, no. And she keeps going and is kind of, like, trying to assault him in a way. And he hits her. And she's never been hit.
Right. That's like, she doesn't has, happen.
Right. It's like, it's totally crazy. And she runs into the bathroom and hides from him. And then he gets a phone call that his mother is in the, not in the hospital, but is dying in
like
the dying
in the hospice
place.
Or something. Yeah. Yeah. So he goes to see her. Mm. And she's still on Soma, so she's just like totally out.
Yeah.
But there's a kind of sad, well, interesting scene, right? So in the Brave New World culture, they want people to be acclimated to dying, mm-hmm. right? So in a place like a hospital where people are dying, they just bring kids, little kids, so they who can play and just be around them.
Right.
So that they...
And they bribe the children with, like, chocolate and stuff yeah. to make them, like, have associate positive
Positive associations,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Conditioning.
Yeah.
And that upsets John because he thinks it's disrespectful when these kids are trying to, like, run over the bed or mm-hmm. hide under the bed.
Or stare at his mother.
Right.
Because she looks different from everyone
right.
else. And he's, you know, he... Simultaneously, he doesn't understand their position, but they don't understand him. The hospital staff are like, why are you so upset?
Right.
And why are you visiting?
Yeah, what's the thing?
And he's like, this is my mother. And they're like, yeah.
Right.
So, I mean, pretty much Linda dies. That's...
Right, so she dies, and then he gets... I think when she leaves the hospital, he sees a bunch of deltas kind of lining up at the end of the ship to get their little Soma tablets, mm-hmm. and he tries to liberate them.
Yeah. Oh, John. Oh, and this is sort of like when the question starts... I mean, I guess the whole story has the question of what is freedom exactly? And what, I mean, we'll get to that.
Right. So, basically, he starts a riot mm-hmm. because... He throws the Soma out the window, and somehow Bernard and Helmholtz come and help him, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure exactly how they got there, but they kind of get in.
They were reacting, they were called, because he was making a fuss.
Okay,
they were,
so they came, but they saw what he was doing, and they kind of got into it with him. So there's a big riot going on, and so they finally get arrested.
Yeah. That means that you have John Savage and then two men from like the upper echelons of this very controlled society that are all kind of outcasts.
Right. I mean they were a little bit of an outcast, right? Bernard and Helmholtz were
not as much as John,
of course, but yeah, they were different.
Yeah.
And they get dragged to Mustafa Mann's office and then the philosophy lesson takes place.
And then the philosophy lesson. I know you like the philosophy lesson, but I don't like the philosophy
right.
lesson.
Right. So there's a couple of things I wanted to say about that. Where's my notes?
You have some quotes from it, right?
Yeah.
There's some beautiful writing in... I will say this. There's some beautiful writing in the philosophy lesson. And I guess my problem with this is that I felt it was a little too heavy-handed in terms of, like, everything Mustafa Mann... It's just exposition, right? They're just using Mustafa... The author is just using Mustafa Mann as a mouthpiece for his philosophy, which is fine. But I think everything Mustafa Mann says is borne out by the story. So it's kind of like the story explaining to you its themes.
Right.
When it's already kind of apparent what the themes are. But
right.
some of the writing is really beautiful. So you picked some good quotes from it, right?
Right. So he's explaining to John, right, saying about civilization. And he says, you know, you can't, you know, liberate deltas. They don't want to be liberated. They're deltas, right? That's what they were made to be. And they talk about Othello, for example, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because he complains that there is no... you know, the feelings are kind of empty and boring and mm-hmm. compared to Shakespeare. And Mustafa Mann explains to him that, you know, if you want stability, you can't have art.
Right.
Or you can't have a religion because you can't make flivvers without steel and you can't make tragedies without social instability. And the other quote that he says, actual happiness always looks pretty squalid in comparison with the overcompensation for misery. Happiness is never grand. And this is when he was trying to, John was trying to say, why don't you write something like Othello, even if this old stuff is not understandable. And he said, nobody will understand it.
Yeah.
And this is how society is stable. There is no tragedies. There is no, you know, heights of emotions or whatever. So
right.
Nobody would get it. And he talks about the Cyprus experiment. Do you remember that?
With the island.
Right. Yeah. Cyprus is an island. They put 20,000 alphas on it to see what would happen.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they got like today's society where everybody's trying to kill each other.
Right.
And they said after 19,000 of the 20,000 that they put on the island were dead. They finally say, no, please, can we go back?
Yeah. And it's sort of this interesting, and I guess it's kind of one of the big points of the story is, you know, what is happiness? And is it really achievable?
Well, the thing that I said here says you can't have happiness and truth and beauty.
You can't have what?
You can't have happiness and truth and beauty because, you know, truth sometimes is not very happy.
Yeah.
Right. And similarly about religion, is that it's not needed if people don't get old and suffer. You know, if you don't suffer anything, what's the point?
It's kind of interesting. It's sort of like the same dichotomy that dystopia and utopia have, is that we're always sort of striving to do things that make us happy, but it's not really possible to achieve happiness unless there is a contrast of not happiness.
Right. Right. There's some Chinese saying that goes like, you know, you cannot appreciate sweet unless you taste bitter.
Right, exactly.
No, speaking about religion, and there's something I was rereading the end today, and Mustafa Mann says about God, you know, so John says, do you believe there is God?
Right.
And Mustafa Mann said, yeah, I think so, maybe. And he says, and you know, in the olden days, God demonstrated itself by being like Old Testament God with lightning and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He says, nowadays, he says, demonstrates himself by being absent.
Yeah. okay, so a few more actual events happen before it ends, and then we can go back and talk about all the various things. So, John.
So they all get punished, right? So the Bernard and Humboldt get exiled to some islands, and apparently we find out that there is many islands that have these people that don't quite fit.
Yeah.
And Humboldt is happy because he says, "I'm just going to go be able to write at what I want and."
Mm.
And Bernard says, no, don't send me. It wasn't me, it was them.
And John remains in England, but goes to
the also goes in exile. So they set up like a place for him where he could live.
Yeah, it's a lighthouse. It's an old lighthouse.
Old lighthouse.
And it's cute. He has like a garden for a bit.
Right, so they give him some money so he can buy some supplies and set himself up. So he sets up a garden. And so then the incident with the arrows happens, right? So he was a, you know, living in Indian, so he knew how to make bows and arrows, and he was going to make those so he could hunt.
Mm-hmm.
And he was sitting there making the arrows, and all of a sudden he realized he was in this state where he's making something and made him happy,
mm-hmm.
right? And he felt that he could not be happy.
He felt really guilty because Linda was dead.
Because Linda was dead also because of the thing with Lenina,
mm-hmm.
and so he said, how can I possibly feel happy? That's totally wrong.
Right.
So he makes a whip.
Yep. And he whips himself. This is strange.
Well, there were some monks and stuff in the Middle Ages that did that kind of stuff.
John needs like a tumbler or something, like to get his emotions.
Some soma, yeah.
He's like So the point is he's whipping himself and some people see him.
Right. So there's some like, I guess they had newspapers still.
Yeah.
And reporters, I guess they recorded feelies though, so you could, you know, when they recorded it, the person watching would feel stuff.
Yeah.
So they saw him whipping himself, and they thought that was kind of amazing, right?
Yeah.
So
like some regular folks see him whipping himself, they report it.
Right.
And then a few days later, news reporters just start popping up.
Right.
And demanding interviews with him and stuff like that. And he obviously is not cool with that life.
Right. And then the whole crowd shows up, and they yell at him, whip yourself,
yeah.
Let's see the whip.
Well, because he kicks one of the reporters that comes, he like turns him around and kicks him in the butt. And so then they report on it, and so then all of these people show up in helicopters, and they want to see him whip himself, they want to see him do all these things, and they're demanding all this stuff. And then
Lenina shows up.
Is it Lenina or is it some other blonde-haired lady?
No, I think it's Lenina.
Because the text does not say Lenina. It says a young woman steps out of the helicopter.
Helicopter. I thought it was Lenina.
I thought it was too. They describe her like looking like Lenina, blonde hair, blue-eyed, everything. But they don't say the word Lenina, so I was never quite sure if it was actually her or if it was just someone that looked like her. Because it kind of works either way. Right. He has a bad reaction
to it. He has a very bad reaction.
Yeah. And what does he do when he sees her?
I don't know. I forgot. What did he do?
I'm pretty sure he whips her.
Oh, he tries to attack her.
He comes at her with the whip. And I don't remember if he actually makes contact. But he tries to whip her, then he whips himself. And then the crowd starts singing the Orgy Porgy song. Oh, which I guess we didn't talk about.
Right.
Orgy Porgy is like a chant that they'll start to do before they have an orgy. And then that's what they do. And the crowd gets really riled up.
Right.
And they start chanting Orgy Porgy. And then the chapter kind of cuts.
Right.
The chapter itself doesn't cut, but the text kind of cuts.
Mm-hmm.
And John wakes up the next morning feeling really bad about everything. So I don't know. You said you didn't think he participated in the orgy. I don't know. I don't know if the implication is that he did.
I don't think he didn't. Yeah.
I'm not sure, but anyway, he's clearly not able to live in his isolation. They won't leave him alone.
Right.
And so then, what happened?
Then he just commits suicide. He hangs himself. So I think the reporters come the next day, and it's quiet. They don't see him, and they go into the lighthouse, and they see him hanging.
Yeah, they see his feet past the archway, dangling. And the last sentence is really nice, it's really artful. It was describing the way the feet are turning from north to northeast to east and then back. I'm going to read the last bit, last two full sentences. So they go into the lighthouse, they're calling for him, they call him Mr. Savage. And then they see, just under the crown of the arch, dangled a pair of feet. Slowly, very slowly, like two unhurried compass needles, the feet turned towards the right. North, northeast, east, southeast, south, south-southwest. Then paused, and after a few seconds, turned as unhurriedly back towards the left. South-southwest, south, southeast, east. I think that's a beautiful description. Yeah. So he dies. What does that mean? I don't know.
Well, he clearly didn't fit into that society. He didn't fit into the Indian society either, so there was no place for him in the world. So it's kind of logical in the movie. So we didn't talk about this. Why is this book called Brave New World?
Because Shakespeare. So what I love, I kind of love when authors do this, when they, clearly like another written work, and so they put it into their own written work. So a lot of what John says all the time is references to Shakespeare. And he uses a lot of old English words like strumpet, and stuff like that.
He uses direct quotations all over the place.
He uses direct quotations because that's the only book he had to read was all the Shakespeare plays. And Brave New World is a quote from
The Tempest.
Oh, Brave New World with such people in it. He quotes that a bunch.
Right.
And that's when
Miranda
sees, I forget the guy's name, the guy that she ends up falling in love with in the Shakespeare play. Spoiler. when she sees him, she says, oh, Brave New World with such people in it. And that's kind of dark in comparison to, that's a very happy, because The Tempest is one of Shakespeare's comedies. Right. It's also the last play Shakespeare ever wrote.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And in contrast to John's experience with the Brave New World, not being so great.
Right.
It's kind of a dark.
Well, he talks about Othello a lot, which is Othello actually, his relationship with Lenina is a little bit Othello-ish as well.
Mm-hmm.
Right, especially he wants to attack her.
Yeah.
It's kind of jealousy, you would think, right?
Yeah, in a lot of ways. I think that there's certainly a very heavy Shakespeare influence on the writing generally, and both within the confines of the story, on the character of John, and also just on the writing as the author went at it. That's the meaning of the title. And I wonder, and that kind of ties back into our whole dystopia conversation, is this is supposed to be a utopia for the characters in the story.
Well, but it's right, not. So that's the question. What is a dystopia? Or why is the story a dystopia?
Well, I guess the question is it a dystopia for everyone? Is it a dystopia for Lenina?
I guess not. She's...
I don't think so, right. So one of the things about the story is the treatment of women is not fantastic.
Right, you can... Actually, now that you mentioned Lenina is a blonde.
Yeah.
She takes everything at face value. You know, things are as they are.
She is perfectly pneumatic.
Right.
One of the common phrases in the story is when you call people perfectly pneumatic, and it just means that they fit perfectly. They're perfectly what they're supposed to be. And Lenina is perfectly pneumatic. She's exactly the box. She checks every checkbox. And she's happy in this world. I think this is a utopia for Lenina. Why would it not be?
So why did she fall for John?
It's probably just because she's... I read her attraction to John just being part of her pattern of being attracted to men. And just the fact that basically...
Right, but I mean, she had to put any men she wanted, and then she...
Because this is the one guy who didn't want her? Or who did want her but wouldn't have her?
You know, maybe she wasn't as pneumatic as you thought. You know,
maybe.
And
maybe there are more shades to her than I'm giving her credit for.
You know, there's the... I guess, you know, everybody else is boring after a while. If it's everybody's the same and, mm-hmm. you know, stable. And here's somebody who's totally different.
Right.
And
exactly. So I think for Lenina, this largely would be utopia, or for her friend Fanny, for example. Whereas, obviously, for Bernard and Hemholtz and John,
right.
this was... by no means a utopia.
Right.
And that was just because they didn't fit in. Right?
Right.
So, is it...
This was a society where fitting in was super important. That was like the major thing.
So is the question, you know, does your view of whether or not it's a utopia or dystopia come from whether or not you fit in to it? Whether or not you're part of it? Because I think a lot of times in dystopia stories, the dystopia portion comes from not being in power.
Right.
So something like 1984, the Hunger Games.
Look here. So power is interesting. Look at Mustafa Mann. Was this dystopia for him or utopia?
Probably dystopia, I would say. That's what's interesting about Bernard and Hemholtz, because they're alphas.
Right.
They're on the high.
But I mean, Mustafa Mann was the world controller.
Yeah.
Right. And yet he had to give something up that was important to him.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you would wind up on the island.
Yeah. So, I mean, So I guess what we're getting at is it seems to be coming down to, for this world, whether or not it's utopia or dystopia, it comes down to whether or not you fit in. What makes those characters not fit in?
Well, Bernard was kind of old-fashioned in the way, you know, mm-hmm. in the way we would think of it. He wanted to just be with one girl, not many,
right.
and he wanted a particular girl.
Right.
Helmholtz was a writer who wanted to create something beyond what was allowed. You know, mm-hmm. Not stupid feelings. He wanted to, you know, have emotions and explore them. Right.
Mm-hmm. I think the common thread between Mustafa Mann, Helmholtz, Bernard, and John is that they're all hyper aware of the society that they're in, and that it's the awareness of the fact that it is so structured to be that way that makes them unhappy in it. You see what I'm saying? Like, Lenina is much less aware of...
I don't think John was aware either. For him, it was more like a gut reaction, because it was like a culture shock, really.
Well, that's what I mean by aware. Like, as in, for Lenina, a lot of these things were just so ingrained in her life that
right.
they were just part of the fabric of
normal.
Existence.
Right, yeah.
You know, why would you sweep the floor? We have vacuums. You know,
right.
like this very, like,
right.
regular... Part of the fabric of her existence.
Right.
Whereas Bernard, Hemholtz, Mustafa Mann, and John all confronted and were questioning those underlying assumptions.
Okay.
And that kind of...
So Mustafa Mann kind of knew what the answers were, and he
right.
kind of picked, he said, you know, this is stability is what I want to support, and
mm-hmm.
that's how I'm going to do it then.
Right, exactly. And so it was sort of this, it's kind of like this meta... thing, where it's like when you're too aware of what you're doing to achieve happiness, it no longer makes you happy.
So in engineering, there's a kind of a joke saying that whenever you want to make something, you can make it good, cheap, or fast. Pick any two. And this is kind of similar. You have art, beauty, and happiness. Mm-hmm. You know, pick any two.
Yeah, but I mean, it's interesting because they are all so interconnected, and I think that it's very true that this kind of ties into what you brought up before, with when you get really when you get really engrossed in making something.
Right.
The allure of that is that when you get so into it, you don't realize you're so into it. Right.
Right.
You don't like the rest of the world.
That's a state called flow. Some people call flow.
Yeah.
Right.
And I'm like, I play a lot of video games, and like the fun of a video game is when you get so into it that you forget about everything else, and all that matters at that point is that video game. But once you realize you're playing that game, like after a while, it gets boring. You play the same game over.
Well, but you know, it's if you're doing creative things, like if you're writing, let's say, you can get into that state too.
I'm just using games as an example.
Yeah.
The point being that, you know, when you get to a point where you do too much of the one thing too long, it's no longer entertaining and fun. I think partially from my own experience, because you become aware of what you're doing.
Well, so maybe one of the reasons this is a dystopia, that everything is always the same. It's just like, you know.
Yeah.
So because maybe you are an alpha, you know. if you are conditioned to, you know, like things that you do and not question anything, then what's the problem?
Exactly. And I think that is reflected within the society that he's built here, with the fact that you have the different the caste system, basically. Right. And
Mustafa Man explains that that's necessary because you can expect alphas to do epsilon work.
And the vast majority of the castes are fine doing it. Right. The only people that seem to be struggling are the alphas. So what is it teaching us?
Don't be smart.
Critical thought is bad, basically. Right?
Well, yeah.
In this kind of society.
Yeah.
So.
Maybe that's why this is a dystopia.
So everyone stop thinking too hard. And everything will be a utopia. But I think that's I don't know if we've quite gotten to it, but I think we're getting to I think the awareness. So then something else you and I were talking about was freedom and free will.
Right.
And why. But I know myself as a modern reader, you know, now in 2019, this was written in the 1930s, I wouldn't want to live in this kind of society. And initially I thought it was a freedom issue, but it's not really freedom because, like, Lenina has lots of freedom. She can do whatever she wants. It's not freedom, it's free will that seems to be the issue.
Right, in the sense that that you get to pick that directed to like things, you know.
Right.
But I mean, one could argue that once you become a member of society,
it's already happening.
It's already happening.
Yeah, exactly.
And like we were saying before, one of the things historically, right, at least in the United States, there was this whole idea of individual freedom, and in, you know, 18th and 19th century, you could really be, I mean, free as probably as a person can be. Mm-hmm. You know, you get your gun, take your supplies, and walk into the wilderness, and you're on your own.
Yeah.
And I was reading a book about the Comanches, who were Indians who lived in the Great Plains, and for a while they were like the major tribe and most powerful one. But they said the way they lived, basically, that's what was freedom. You kind of camped somewhere, you know, you went hunting, you hanged out, and then you did whatever you wanted, and then went somewhere else.
Yeah.
And when Industrial Revolution happened and people started working for a living in like factories or having to have jobs to earn money, and there's a reason why it's called being a wage slave.
Yeah.
And at the time, like when society was changing from this kind of, you know, work where you can kind of be all on your own somewhere in the middle of the world, to having to work for a living, some people objected to that. Some people thought that was, you were really losing your freedom. Nowadays, we don't think of it that way.
Well, I think that freedom in that way, so being able to take your gun and go off into the woods is freedom when you're young and healthy. But a lot of that, freedom is sort of a double-edged sword, because you can, when you have more freedom in terms of more individuality and more individual autonomy,
right,
you lose those connections to society. You lose a lot of things that otherwise would allow
freedom. Right. So then you have something like the Comanches. So there was a tribe of people who kind of worked together, mm-hmm. but you still have a lot of freedom. And their society was not structured as strictly as ours. You know, so there were people who were, you know, elder, maybe more experienced and stuff, but there was no formal structures like where somebody was the chief and told you what to do, mm-hmm. you know.
I guess one of the interesting things about human civilization generally is that we really only achieve things on a large scale when we work in mass.
That's right.
Whether we're working willingly or not.
Right.
And, you know, we are innately social creatures. So the balance of freedom and individuality versus the collective is...
I mean, look at the Borg right now. There's a nice collective there.
Yeah. They got a lot done. But free will is a little bit different. Free will is kind of... Freedom is just like, you know, today I feel like eating a hamburger and you go get a hamburger.
Right.
And there's all kinds of things that could prevent you from getting that hamburger. Your income, your access to hamburgers, your whatever. But free will is the ability to... pick your own destiny, not to sound too much like a Hallmark card, but like really to choose your own destiny, which is also controlled.
Freedom is a little bit more than just, you know, deciding to have a hamburger. You know, what if you want to express an opinion that is unpopular, right? You want to write stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And when we get to 1984, we'll talk about that.
Which, you know, innately a lot of freedoms invoke the need for protection. You know, if you want the freedom of speech, you need the protection to know you have that.
Right.
From the people around you, unless you want to go into the woods with your gun and shout at the trees, which I mean, you can. So free will, I think, is sort of interesting here because this is sort of back to another story you and I read a while ago with the Weird Alien Story of Your Life by Ted Chiang.
Right.
And that was the aliens who, their perception of time made them see everything at once, pretty much.
Right.
And not linearly, and the fact that being able to predict the future makes it impossible to have free will.
Right.
Right. Because if the future is predetermined. Right. So in this way, in the society, by the conditioning, the future's predetermined.
That's true.
So what does Lenin?
Everybody's happy, and
does Lenin have free will?
Good question.
I don't know. So I mean, I think that's one of the big things.
You want to talk about gender? Oh no! What is this thing?
The Bechdel test.
Yeah.
Okay, so the Bechdel test is in any form of media, books, movies, whatever. Does your story contain two female characters who talk to each other about something other than a man? The answer in Brave New World is no. So we have failed the Bechdel test, and we fail it pretty hard throughout the whole story.
And that's like I said before, this book it's an interesting book in a sense that it's, you know, about future and science fiction-y mm-hmm. kind of a thing, although it's a little bit of a satire. Yet the attitude of roles of the sexes that mm-hmm. existed in the 1930s just comes through it so hard.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I think that's true probably for all the science fiction we'll see, and even science fiction that's being written, you know, nowadays, 100 years from now, when someone else is doing a podcast, they'll look back and be like, wow, can you believe this? Because, you know, authors can be creative really only to a point. We are, people are limited by, you know, what they can...
Imagine.
And one of the things I found interesting here, I think the story ages pretty well. I think the sexism issue is probably one of the bigger issues, but it's also kind of part of the commentary, so it kind of works.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the biggest things that, as a modern reader, is definitely missing is any kind of homosexuality, any kind of LGBT representation, particularly if the whole shtick of the society is everyone belongs to everyone else to support, like, the free sex kind of thing.
Right.
If that's true, then everyone should be pansexual. Then everyone should have, or bisexual, whichever way you want to put it. Because, you know, why limit yourself to 50% of the population?
Right.
If we can adjust the embryos, you know, in the embryonic stage, then just make everyone bisexual.
Right.
And then everyone really does belong to everyone else.
And that's just a reflection of 1930s.
Right, exactly. Exactly. It's like not even something that would have crossed his mind.
Right. I'm sure it crossed his mind, but it's just not something he talked about.
Yeah. I mean, tons of articles have been written on gender in Brave New World. I actually know that one of our writers over at the Fandamentals, which is the other podcast I'm on with the Fundamentals, I think it was Julia, she wrote an article about specifically about gender in Brave New World. I did not read it because I didn't want to steal her ideas, but I'm sure it's great. I'm going to read it when we're done with this podcast. I mean, gender in Brave New World is super interesting. Like you were saying, the ideas still, like the sort of, the ideas about gender and the gender roles.
The way I think of it, it's like the flavor of the times leaks through this.
Yeah, exactly. And you can see that in some of the language, the women, you know, the women's roles in the story and in the society. And the fact that, you know, Lenina turns out to be...
Like Mustafa Mond was a man, right?
Right, like all the higher-ups are men, and Lenina is, like, kind of not... She's not exactly a character.
She's blonde.
Yeah. Exactly. She's not really a character. She kind of becomes, like, a litmus test. She's kind of, like, more of an object of the men around her. So, like, the way that... She's kind of there to be something that John reacts to be something that Bernard reacts to. And she does have her own reactions to an extent, but they're not, like, very deep and profound or anything along those lines.
Actually, it would be interesting to think which couples from Shakespeare there would be. So you said Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah.
I thought of Othello and Desdemona. What other ones were famous ones?
I was an English major, but I don't really remember.
Yeah, but...
Well, Miranda and whoever Miranda's lover is in Brave New World.
Right. Maybe.
That's how into Shakespeare I am. I like Shakespeare, I haven't read the plays in a long time. One thing I thought that was really well done, that still works even today, is that as a modern reader, both the savage society and the civilized society had positive and negatives for me, right? Because I look at the savage society and it's like, quote unquote dirty or whatever, and like not advanced, but then there's families and there's like the human element. And then you look at the quote unquote civilized and it's like cleaner and more modern, but then like nobody has a family, nobody has kids, nobody does anything of import. Because they
No truth of beauty.
Right. And I think that's a really interesting...
Remember that scene, wasn't Bernard who took Lenina on a helicopter ride somewhere and they kind of hovered over the ocean, wanted to just see the ocean?
Mm-hmm.
And she like really hated it.
Yeah. She's like, what are we doing? And he's like, I'm trying to live and enjoy the world. And she's like, what are we... I don't understand. She is a blonde.
What are we doing next?
I don't know. What are we doing?
1984?
Yeah, what else do you want to do in terms of dystopias? 1984, we talked about maybe reading the first Hunger Games book, right?
Right.
Would you watch the movie with me, too?
I saw the movie.
Oh, you saw the movie?
Yeah.
Oh, we can watch it again.
Yeah.
I like the first Hunger Games movie.
I wanted to do Return from the Stars, which is Lemon.
Okay.
But we can do it later.
I've accepted my fate. I have no free will when it comes to reading Lem. My future has been predetermined. And then we need a fifth one, right? We do five? What else do we have?
Well, we can do Philip K. Dick.
Oh, God. Okay.
But, which is a popular one, or Handmaiden's Tale.
Oh, yeah.
Which I haven't read. Maybe we should do that.
I haven't read and haven't watched the show.
Me neither.
Oh, that'd be... Because that's a pretty modern one, right? It's pretty recent.
And, right. And I'm going to read Ted Chiang, see if there's anything in there that's
appropriate. Yeah. Yeah, Ted Chiang just came out with a new book of short stories, is it?
Yeah, it's another book of short stories. I don't know how new it is. It's about maybe a year old. I just found it.
It's new for us. So next we'll do 1984. I love 1984.
Okay.
I recently reread 1984, but I'll reread it again.
I have an audiobook as well, so...
Maybe I'll do the audiobook, because I know I remember all the characters in that one. I'm going to get confused. 1984 was a book that when I was in high school, I read it when Chris had read it. So, for you listeners, a look into our lives. I have an older brother, and he was a few years older than me in school, so a lot of times I read stuff a little earlier, because he was reading it, and he'd get into it, and he got really into 1984. Mm. So I read it. And then when I got to it in high school, I had already read it and all these things. And I fought with my teacher about that book.
Really?
Oh, my gosh.
I want to hear about
like
that.
Like a crazy person. I was, like, screaming. Like, I was awful. I was really not... Nobody liked me in school.
Not true.
But I fought with her about it. And I also taught her what the coral as a metaphor was. The coral and the paperweight. She had no idea. But anyway, I love 1984, so that'll be a really good one. And then, yeah, we can do whichever one after that you want to do. Hunger Games is really short.
Yeah, okay.
And really poorly written, but interesting.
That's fine.
So you've seen the movie, but
I've seen the movie. I haven't read the book, so.
It won't take you long to read the
book. Yep.
They're very similar. It's actually very good. The movie's a pretty good adaptation, yeah. So we should do that, because last time, in our last batch, we did a shorter one than a movie.
Right.
Okay. Well, I think that's everything we have for this one. I hope we didn't blow your mind too much. But thanks so much for listening to History in Reverse.
And we'll see you next time.
You want to tell me about the strange alien?
Yeah, so I read this book called Diaspora by Greg Egan. Mm-hmm. And he's a physicist, and he's very strange.
Those go part and parcel.
And in this book, his characters go visit this planet that is covered by an ocean. Mm-hmm. And inside the ocean, there's a thing that looks like a carpet, but it keeps growing. Ooh. And it turns out it's a molecular computer.
A what?
A computer.
Okay.
But biological computer, right? So, and the alien, and it's running like a virtual universe. Mm-hmm. And the aliens are the things inside that universe running on this computer.
Oh my God. That's crazy. I love it.